My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome to Unlock Your Potential. This is Jeff Lerner, your host. Always so excited to welcome you back. Here we get to have amazing conversations with amazing human beings. In this episode, we are joined by Dr. Ian McGilchrist. I've been very excited about this episode for a long time, and I'm excited to introduce you to the conversation that I've been very much looking forward to. Dr. McGilchrist is a former fellow of All Souls College at Oxford University, the oldest English-speaking university in the world. He is also a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and a fellow of Green Templeton College, also in Oxford. Dr. McGilchrist is committed to the idea that the mind and the brain can be understood only by seeing them in the broadest possible context, that of the whole of our physical and spiritual existence, and of the wider human culture, the culture which helps to mold and in turn is molded by our minds and brains. I think without saying any more, I'm just gonna invite you to strap in, get excited about what, for me at least, was a really, really profound conversation that I believe you're gonna enjoy and benefit from as well. So without further ado, enjoy my conversation with Dr. Ian McGilchrist. Dr. McGilchrist, welcome to Unlock Your Potential. I'm so grateful to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
So where are you right now?
Well, I'm snowbound pretty much on one of the Hebrides, the Isle of Skye off the northwest coast of Scotland. Very beautiful place, but not very practical for some reasons.
and yet there you find yourself. I know you moved there after your career, which I assume was based, you know, down in England, being at Oxford as you were. But how long have you been in Isle of Skye?
I've had this place for about 22 years, but I've been living here full time, I'd say only for about half of that, because I'm still working in London until I decided to just retire, basically. And like so many people who've retired, I've worked at least as hard since retiring as I did before, but because I've been basically talking and writing.
Well, I watched my father do the same thing. He retired in his early 50s, and really, I think in a sense, his true career began when he retired. And it was it was a pastiche of what he did before, which is money management, but also trading in rare books, woodworking, very serious fly fishing that I think edged into work, not just recreation. And yeah, I think he worked harder than ever as a retired person. So.
Yeah, there we go. Some of us just can't let it go.
Well, I will say, first of all, for the audience and for yourself, there's a little bit of a lag. Apparently, whatever it takes to get an audio signal from, I'm in Linden, Utah. So to get from Linden, Utah to Isle of Skye, Scotland, is producing some sort of lag between us. So I'm going to occasionally pause to avoid overlap. But okay. I want to give a little bit of context for this episode. As you sort of alluded to when you know, before I hit record and when you came on, you said, well, I'm not much of a subject matter expert on entrepreneurialism. And certainly I don't presume to be any sort of subject matter expert on that range of subjects upon which I've experienced you to be a subject matter expert. One might question, why did Dr. Ian McGilchrist come on Unlock Your Potential podcast, right? So I want to sort of set us up with that question. And I assume, have you wondered, like, why did this guy reach out to me and want to have me on this show?
Yes, I did, rather. I admit that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me illuminate for everyone. So I first met you, so to speak, on the Jordan Peterson podcast. Okay. And I've listened to that episode at least three times now. And I'm a former musician. I don't think one is ever a former musician. I'm a former professional musician. I would say I'm a very serious dilettante musician, but I felt something, very fugue-like in your conversation with Dr. Peterson. This interplay of themes sort of reworking themselves and twisting and cavorting together and producing something sort of ephemerally beautiful. And
I've just sort of followed an instinct to say, I would like to have this man on my show. And that's really it.
Well, there we are. I wonder which conversation that was, because I've had three that have been online now with Jordan.
It was the one around the matter of things.
Oh, okay. So that'll be the latest one, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I did listen to one of the earlier ones as well.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. And so, we had a fun interview when Jonathan Rowson, who ran the Social Brain Project at the Royal Society of Arts in London, just said to me, I don't suppose you happen to be in London on this particular date because Jordan Peterson's coming to speak and it would be good for you to meet. And I just happened to be in London. So I went. I'd never read anything of his. I'd seen a couple of podcasts. He'd never read anything of mine. He'd seen a podcast or two. And we just sat down and we had half an hour before he had to catch a plane to France. And we just went shoot like that. And we had a half hour interview, which I really enjoyed, because the ideas were just zinging backwards and forwards. It's much shorter than the other two that we've done, which were more planned. But anyway, I think it had its own kind of life, really. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's like, I know you're a serious student of classical music. It reminds me of some of the magic that can happen in shorter form pieces. I think of like, even like Beethoven's Bagatelles or even some, you know, like Chopin Nocturnes, where there's a very limited window of time and you kind of have to cram all the magic in and it can be really wonderful.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
So, you know, subsequent to saying, I reached out to Bo who books the show and helps me with a lot of business development for the show. And I said, I'd really like to, I don't know how one's, you know, do we send a carrier pigeon to Isle of Skye or whatnot, but however we reached Dr. McGilchrist, I would really love to have him on the show. And then you said yes. And then the real machinations began. And I'll tell you why I've been so excited about this. You know, it's funny, like, and I think you'll take this in the spirit in which I intend it. You know, I record at least one or two episodes a week for the show. And there's a number of people around me that are involved in the show. And some of the people around me have commented, they're like, Jeff, I've really never seen you like this about a guest. You seem, you know, you seem like you're probably like you're having The Rock come on your show or Michael Jordan come on your show. And I mean, take that for what it's worth. And what I'm, the reason is because I think this is, you know, I'm taking this, and I'm not trying to put too much pressure on us here, but I'm taking this as an opportunity to take a step in the direction of what I, you know, here I am 250 episodes deep into this show, and I'm finally going to declare to my audience and even to myself what it is that I'm really after here with this show. And I would sum it up as simply a philosophy of entrepreneurialism. That I believe there is, and I know we align in this regard, having read, I've read most of the Master and His Emissary and a bit of The Matter of Things. So that's my exposure to your work, which, as you know, most of the former and some of the latter, that equates to, you know, 30 hours of listening. They're very comprehensive books. But, you know, I know from that we align in this regard, that there is a, I'm going to use the term non-medically. There's almost seems to be like a schizophrenia in the world today that I would describe as like a disjointedness of thoughts, a crisis of existence, a despondence of feeling, a tragic veering off of, you know, the human experience. And it manifests through conflict, through aggression, through fear, through all this stuff that we can experience so readily anytime we log onto a social media platform. And I, perhaps by projection of my own life experience, have arrived at sort of this belief system around entrepreneurialism as a sort of a cure-all for much of what ails us as a society. And if I stand, I think if my work is trying to do something, it's to bring entrepreneurialism, which I even use that term distinct from entrepreneurship, as the practice or the application of entrepreneurial thought or ideas. But the thought itself and the ideas themselves, I believe, have a more holistic opportunity, or give us a more holistic opportunity for healing of a lot of what ails us as a society. And that, I think naming that and claiming that and trying to pull entrepreneurship out of the what it's become, which is a sort of, to use some of your term, I think we have left-brained the concept of entrepreneurship to the point of, you know, reductionist materialism, where when people think of becoming entrepreneurs, what they really think about, it, they sort of map themselves against the Silicon Valley avatar of a young, cool billionaire who can get any girl he wants or any guy she wants and drive any car and be on the cover of a magazine and be a significant figure in culture now. And it's, and I think it's horrifying because, you know, there's 30, even as a practical matter, entrepreneurs, there's 31 million small and medium-sized business owners in the United States that do not at all adhere to that notion of entrepreneurship. These are good, you know, hardworking people that create jobs. I think small businesses pay, you know, over 60% of the taxes, at least in the United States. They have more, I think, and there's a lot of data to support this. They have different qualities of life, different levels of health, lower incidences of diabetes, more, you know, a lot of the things that I think, you know, physiologically, psychologically, spiritually, and so forth come from essentially being empowered and in control of their life, in the sense that that concern, which they attend to every day in order to survive and get paid and make a life, is something that they also get to express themselves through because it is theirs. Mm-hmm. And I think that is nurturing at the soul level and so much more interesting to me than just how can I invent the next whatever and become famous and make a bunch of money, which again is what I think entrepreneurship has turned into. And that if I'm going to really try to push for a philosophy of entrepreneurialism, I should probably be talking to actual philosophers, not just entrepreneurs. So there, that is why I've been so excited to have you on the show.
Well, good. You seem to be making a distinction between the creative aspects, I think, in which the person is genuinely being creative rather than just pursuing financial gain, which one can do in a really very unimaginative, uninteresting way. Is that the distinction that you're conveying there?
Yeah, it is. And to sort of unpack that with a little more context, I have an entrepreneurial education platform, a company, an entrepreneurial venture that's actually called Entra Institute. And we are one of the largest and fastest growing education platforms, virtual platforms in the world. So we've had about 270,000 students enroll at some level. You know, that might just be, I took a little $39 teaser course or whatnot, but we've had over 250,000 students in 4 years. And in that, I present a framework, sort of what I'm really trying to develop is, for lack of a better way to say it, sort of a life operating system that, you know, I think about, you know, this sort of scientific quest for singular theories to encompass the breadth of observation, right? Einstein, obviously, sort of physics being the most famous, where you have the very small scale and the very large scale, and we're trying to reconcile it with a unified theory. I'm kind of trying to come up with a unified theory of living that can empower people to tend to the practical and the psychical, if you will, right? That, like, I think one of the challenges in society is that we've become very sort of bifurcated or fragmented between what we do to get by or make a living or make a mark or sort of what we might call the professional. And then we think of that as something that we have to clock out of to go experience the personal. And I believe that there is a unified way of living where our being and our doing can converge, and we can actually start to have personal fulfillment through the work that we do, which this is a very historically you know, valid notion that has sort of been, I don't know, it seems like there's a, in the current world, there's a strata of people who, and I would use, let's say yourself or Jordan Peterson or myself, or let's say a small subset of people who are viewed as deriving a lot of personal fulfillment from their work. But then you have the vast majority who think of work as something to be endured, to be clocked into, endured, and then clocked out of, so that then they can go get what they really want their life to be about. And I see entrepreneurialism as a way to heal that very artificial dichotomy, which I can't help but observe in some ways parallels the dichotomy that I've come to know so much about from your work of the left brain and the right brain. I feel like most people are taking a very left brain pedantic approach to their work. And then they try to check out of it and go have some sort of meaningful experience in the right brain portion of their life. But that, that becomes a very, very small portion of their existence. Because frankly, as just an economic reality, it's getting harder and harder, and it's requiring more and more just to survive practically. Right? And so, whatever that's worth.
Yeah, I mean, what you're referring to, I think, is the all too obvious way in which work has become less fulfilling, more mechanical. And, you know, we think that machines are going to spare us a lot of drudgery, but in fact, machines produce a lot of drudgery, and actually it spills over into our everyday life. So, for example, I'm, like many people, observing that things take much longer to achieve in the, you know, incredibly boring things like paying a bill, getting a license, changing a contract, or whatever it might be. Something that could be done and was done in 5 minutes with a phone call now takes hours on the internet while you try to find the appropriate way of resolving this, and you get into kind of MC Escher-like loops in which you go round and round, and then finally the thing says, oops, something went wrong. Then you have to try and ring a number, and you literally are on hold for an hour, hour and a half before you speak to somebody who then is not enjoying their work because they have become almost a machine themselves. They are programmed to say only certain things, to have kind of preformed responses. And we're just, we're crazily committing suicide, in my view, as imaginative human beings. We're turning ourselves into incredibly limited machines. I mean, we've got this fantasy that machines are so clever because of this phrase artificial intelligence. I say it's not artificial intelligence at all. It's a kind of artificial stupidity. And in fact, it's, if it's anything at all, it's information processing, okay? So it's artificial information processing. It can do that fast. But that's not enough to give meaning to life or to restore the time that it robs from us. I mean, a lot of my time, I know, is being robbed from me by a mechanical, bureaucratic, administrative way in which everything is now achieved. This is anti-life. It's anti-human. It's anti-creative. And, you know, you may well say, yes, it seems very much like what I'm describing. And I think you're right. I would say, though, to anyone who's listening who doesn't know my work, my two best-known books are The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World, which came out in 2009, and The Matter with Things, which is came out only a year ago, Our Brains, Our Delusions and the Unmaking of the World. And really, I'm taking a completely new stand, if you like, on what the differences between the two brain hemispheres are. So I just want to put that in case people go, oh no, not all that stuff about hemispheres, that was all, you know, blown out of the water years ago. Yeah, the bad old stuff was, but there still are very important, very, very important differences between these hemispheres, and we mustn't ignore them. And so I'm talking about something slightly different from what people who don't know my work may assume.
Well, so there's two things I want to kind of close loops on. One is you mentioned about creativity, and I sort of went on a riff and never brought it home. So in my platform, which the reason I started talking about it is we introduce a framework where we organize life between the physical, the personal, and the professional ultimately as the underpinning for the what we call the fourth P, which is our purpose, right? So that's at the highest level. If somebody's like, what is this Jeff guy really all about? It's like, I'm building a life operating system where we tend to the physical, personal, and professional in support of ultimately the discovery of and the realization of our purpose. So there's four P's that my whole world centers around. But in the professional, I organize our professional, call it value creation, into three types of channels. One of which is financial, but another of which is actually creativity, right? So typically that I actually believe that creativity is a, call it a professional metric or a professional key performance indicator. And that there are many people who are pursuing great, what they might consider professional achievements. But, you know, I like to dig deep into words, and I've appreciated your work so much because you really like to dig into the meaning of words. But that word professional, somebody says, oh, I'm so professionally successful. I'm so professionally fulfilled or whatnot. And I ask them, based on your profession of what is it that you are professing in your work? Right. And that if we are not creating or expressing or drawing out of ourselves that which is uniquely and indelibly us through our work, then there is a hollowness to professional achievement. And so that you kind of asked about where does creativity come in entrepreneurship, that I believe work and art, and maybe this is by virtue of having formerly been a professional jazz musician who became an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. but I simply view business or entrepreneurship as a type of canvas or a type of instrument with which to create something that did not previously exist, right? So anyway, I wanted to close the loop on that idea for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, maybe you can run with that because I forgot the second thing I was going to say.
Yeah, I mean, one of our problems is inability to trust. And there are many reasons why we don't, and some of them are very valid, but this is not a very helpful way to go, where you micromanage everything according to a scheme that you've got in advance of what's happening. Because what is very important is that a process unfurls organically and things become apparent as the process continues. And if you just have, first of all, decided from the outset to close things down so that you follow a certain path, and then micromanage whoever it is who's trying to do this work for you, you produce only mediocrity. I mean, there's no chance of good creativity coming out of this. So what you have to do is take a risk. You have to take people who have some kind of proven track record of being intelligent and imaginative, and then give them a hell of a lot of time and space to do what they want to do. That's my belief. And I think that this is how things like the Rank Corporation and, you know, other employers of the intelligent inventors of the 60s and 70s worked. And we've lost that, I think. There are many technical advances that sort of build on something that's been done, but there aren't any huge breakthroughs in ideas such as the ones that, you know, were very, very common in the middle of the 20th century. So, I put this down to the fact that we have fallen in love with a kind of ungenerous micromanagement, an unwillingness to let people play really with ideas in order to come up with something interesting, and not sort of like breathing down their necks. So what have you come up with? Hey, what have you published, and what patented or patentable results have you come up with? You sometimes have to wait a hell of a long time. And that's not something people are prepared to do.
Well, and especially in the world today where, you know, you talk, and you and Jordan Peterson talked a lot about attention. You know, time is highly subjective, and time is entirely something that exists. You know, it's phenomenological, right? Like, we only know about it through our own experience of it. And so as our brains change, as our ability to hold attention changes, which I think doesn't even need to be explained in the modern world, our level of patience, essentially our relationship with time changes. Yeah. And like you said, what 50 or 60 years ago might have been tolerable to say, hey, so-and-so has been tinkering for 3 months. I'm excited to see what they end up coming up with. Now is intolerable. So-and-so has been tinkering for 3 months. What the hell is taking so long? Right. Mm. But a lot of that is happening up here.
But everything.
Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the really important things can't be rushed. I mean, they may happen slowly or quickly, but that's another matter. They will happen when they happen. There's a certain amount of preparing the ground that goes on that at the time doesn't seem fruitful. You know, exploring certain things that may not immediately result in something. But actually, this process very rarely is completely lost. The things that you explore, I mean, this has been my personal experience, that I often hadn't got a clear vision of why I was doing certain things. And at the time, they didn't produce anything, you know, marketable, or, you know, not that that's my way of living anyway, but in the end, I think the big achievements, the big visions only come with time, and you can't rush the pace of it. So you really can choose. You can choose to want this now and direct it and micromanage it, and you will never, not even once, get anything worthwhile. You'll only get the mediocre. You can get as much mediocrity as you like, and maybe your interest is in marketing mediocrity, in which case, good luck, and I hope it makes you happy. But really, what you're talking about, it seems to me, is that we need freedom to be able to think in unusual ways, to be able to bring together and make connections between things that are not normally connected. This is how many of the greatest discoveries in mathematics and science were made, as I detail many of the cases in The Matter with Things. But this form of creativity is something that we're losing from our world, and with it we're losing the enjoyment of a working life. Work doesn't have to be, as I think you hinted, work doesn't have to be sort of in contrast with living. This idea of the work-life balance. I mean, hang on. Work is something that should be enjoyable, but it's not going to be enjoyable if you're treated simply as a cog in a machine. I mean, you're never going to enjoy it.
So I want to sort of break the fourth wall here and say to anybody listening, you know, I think at this point, this show has attracted a variety of different audiences, but still primarily, I would say it's entrepreneurial. It's an aspirational entrepreneurial audience, meaning they're either looking to become an entrepreneur or an entrepreneur looking to thrive or grow that enterprise, whatnot, and develop as entrepreneurs. So I want to say to everybody listening that I think a lot of what Dr. McGilchrist just said is, even if it's not maybe immediately obvious, is truly a masterclass along multiple dimensions of business or commercial leadership, in terms of how you lead your own team and also how you try to experientialize your product or service for your customers. And then in my unique case, perhaps how you teach people about entrepreneurship. And in all three of those facets, what I mean is the tyranny of immediate expectations. And I talk a lot about in my work, especially in trying to encourage and nurture people, you know, to venture out into entrepreneurship or into an entrepreneurial way of living, that we live in a world now where people are so gripped with fear and with a false or unsatisfiable need for a priori certainty about the outcome, which, to your point, there is no such certainty, that I use this analogy a lot of people wanting to know that all the lights are green before they will leave their house. Mm. Yes, and yes. If I could cure anything in society, it would be this. Mm. It would be this Yep. Distorted and pathological relationship with time, and the our it's not only that we've lost a sense of delayed gratification. I think beyond that, even we've lost our enjoyment of the process.
Well, that's a very good point, that we need to be focusing as much on the process itself as on the outcome. The outcome will always be unknown. At least the exciting thing is that it will be unknown. If it's already known, it's not interesting, frankly. It's that encounter with the unknown. And so it's ludicrous to focus only on that. You need to focus on the process and wait until the whatever it is happens. And what's more, you can't actually force that process. Nobody ever sat down and said, I'm now going to write a great poem. I mean, they'll write some kind of perfectly acceptable scribble, but it's not going to be a great poem because they said they were going to sit down and write it. And you know, as a musician, that you can't, these things, they have a bit of a life of their own. They're an encounter. We come to encounter something, and we will never, never encounter it if we're always enclosed in our own schema of how this is going to be achieved and what it's going to look like when it arrives. We've got to be open to the unknown, and that's scary for people nowadays. Uncertainty. We live in a society which is pathologically averse to risk. But life is a ridiculously risky business. I mean, it ends in death. This is a risky thing. And it does for everybody, by the way. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter how much you play safe. There is risk there. And it's the risks that you take, not stupid, blind risks, but risks that have something about them that speaks to you. This looks interesting. This looks like it's worth exploring. I can't altogether say exactly why at the moment. And often what one is dealing with there is something that it can only be known at an intuitive level to begin with. And it will become more overt. What is latent, what is implicit, will become more overt and more explicit over the course of time. Or it won't. I mean, we can't get away from that fact. It may or it may not. But as I say, we haven't got the luxury of waiting, as you put it, until all the lights are green and we know what everything's going to be before we start. Because that way, nothing new, nothing interesting is ever going to happen. And in science, one of the worst things now is that people will only get a grant if they can more or less say what it is they expect to find. And the interesting thing is that scientific experimentation often finds something else. It either doesn't demonstrate what it was setting out to prove, but that is itself important. You know, negative experiments are just as important as positive experiments. They change our thinking about this. So, you know, we mustn't always think that we can, you know, produce the sort of thing that we've got in mind before we start. We have to keep an open mind.
So two elements I want to hone in on from what you just said. One is this idea of pathological risk aversion, which thank you for applying that label to it, because I heartily agree that our risk aversion has actually become our greatest systemic risk, both individually and collectively. In fact, actually, let's start there. So let's hone in on risk. And actually, it's interesting. I'm going to sort of map this to the master and his emissary, which I'll just say this. I'm going to record an intro after we're done talking that will frame you and your work and your books. But I'm just going to interject on the fly here to anybody listening. Like, if you pick up one of Dr. McGilchrist's books, you might immediately be struck with two observations. One is, this is very large and long, and it will take a lot of time to get through. And the other is, perhaps, how does this apply to my life? I'm going to tell you right now that, especially almost as an expression of this whole concept that we're talking about not seeing how all the lights are green, I promise you will be surprised at all the ways that understanding the bihemispherality dynamics of the human brain and how it's evolved our perception of the world and how it's been influenced by the world, like I cannot even begin to quantify for you all the delightful things you'll discover about yourself and your place in the world through these books. So let me just say that for the record. But going back to the opening of The Master and His Emissary, where you talk about essentially the fundamental notion of a bihemispheric brain is that at a biological or evolutionary level, two things must always be happening. We must always be focalizing. We must always be narrowing our field in order to go in, grasp things and utilize them for our self-perpetuation, i.e. a bird honing in on a worm and eating it, for example. And that's what the left brain tends to do. And then simultaneously, we must be having this sort of 360 degree, you know, both literal and metaphorical perception of our world and creating context and creating gestalt and assembling all the parts into a cohesive sum so that something else doesn't hone in on us and eat us, right? Basically, it's our alarm yeah. system, right? And that those have to be happening simultaneously, even in some of the most simplistic organisms. And so the point is, the part of the brain, for purpose of that analysis, the part of the brain that mitigates risk is actually the right brain, because it's the thing that keeps the whole context in view or in consciousness. And yet I feel like society now has gotten so left brain, so granular, so myopic in our attempts to escape risk or to overcome risk, that we're actually setting ourselves up for the greatest risk of all, which is losing the greater context.
I completely agree. I mean, this loss of the whole context is so risky that it risks destroying our civilization and possibly our species. I mean, we're at a very risky place now because of our pursuit of needing to have everything certain and in place. This is a very bad way to live. So, yeah, I mean, what one must emphasize is that the left hemisphere had this reputation in the bad old days when pop psychology got the hemispheres wrong. The reputation of the left hemisphere was, well, it might be a little bit boring, but it was at least down to earth and extremely reliable, you know. And it's not reliable at all. It sees only tiny parts of the picture. It jumps to conclusions. It gets in a stress as soon as it finds it's not in control. It is aggressive. It's angry. It's upset. It's not unemotional. It's unintelligent. I mean, literally less intelligent than the right hemisphere, both cognitively and emotionally and socially. So really, it's a disaster to be constantly leading our lives driven by this part of our brain, which is so simple-minded that it just thinks life's about going and getting things and going straight for them and grabbing them. Well, I'm afraid, as a psychiatrist, I can tell you that people who live lives like that, they may make a lot of money, but they're not happy. They're not happy, they're not fulfilled. And they're actually a bit crass. It's very sad. So nobody should aspire to be this. And as a civilization, we shouldn't be cultivating this as our best effort at what it means to be human beings, to be here in this beautiful and complex world. We should be thinking about it in a completely different way. And my work has been nothing less than an attempt to take people from the world that they inhabit and that they may not have been able to question fully, although deep in their hearts they may have thought, this is not right, there's something wrong with this, I don't really believe all this stuff that people are saying, but nonetheless I can't see how to break out of it or how to find out what's wrong with it. I'm trying to take them by the hand and show them a wholly different world, a living world, a complex world, a beautiful world, a subtle world, not this heap of material, this reductionist idea that it's all just bits of matter that mean nothing, randomly colliding with other bits of matter in a universe that has no purpose and no structure. And I don't believe this at all. And I try to show how a completely different picture is both more reliable in terms of the science and in terms of the wisdom traditions of East and West and in terms of our experience of life. And of course, it's all grounded for me in the neurology of the brain and how the brain works. And you take it from me, this kind of thinking that you're describing is pathological, and it's not intelligent, it's not clever, it is actually stupid, uncreative, and it's actually in the process of destroying our world.
So I'm curious then, what is your take? Forgive, it may be a silly question, although it's perhaps the most important question. How did we get here? Is the current state of society a natural consequence of, let's call it, Enlightenment thinking? You know, the scientific revolution, or did at some point the scientific revolution get hijacked?
Yes. Well, the scientific revolution what we mean by that is a process in which we became more certain than we had any right to be, that we could understand everything by likening it to a machine. And this has turned out to be at the core of our catastrophe. So I'm not here to be a critic of the Enlightenment. It achieved many fine ends. It removed from our lives things that had no place in them, but it was hubristic. It has become pursued by people in such a way that what they think is that they know and understand everything. And the trouble is that the more you know, the more you become aware that you don't really know that much. This in psychology, something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, which basically says that the less you know, the more you think you know, and vice versa. So it's a huge problem for us. And I think it is that kind of thinking. I think there are a number of things that led to it. One is the expansion of both a material geographical empire and a kind of commercial and material empire. So in The Master and His Emissary, in the second half of the book, I look at the history of the West up till the very present day, from the ancient Greeks onwards, and look at the various changing points or turning points in the history of ideas. And effectively what we see is that the right and left hemisphere can balance one another and harmonize, but at a certain point in the history of a civilization, the left hemisphere, although knowing much less than the right hemisphere, starts to dominate. Its message is simple, it's conveyable easily in words, and it makes people seem powerful. And so it's addictive. But as the Greeks pointed out, you know, the whole of the wonderful work of Greek tragedy is to show that hubris, when you believe you are as great as the gods and you know the answers to all the questions, comes before a downfall. That is what tragedy is. Tragedy is when human beings think they know it all. And I'm afraid we're in that world right now. You hear it from many people, including some of the most vocal voices in science, who really ought to know a hell of a lot better, because in science, the more we discover, the more we realize how much we need to discover.
So I've learned to trust my instincts as an interviewer and a host. And my instincts just immediately took me perhaps where a lot of listeners' minds just took them. And then my left brain, my right brain, my self-preservation contextual alarm system just said, no, don't go there. But I think I'm going to override it and I'm going to go there.
Okay.
Do you think that the way we as a species responded to the pandemic, it was in any way reflective of this dynamic that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, the key phrase there is "in any way," and I'm sure that it does.
I gave you a lot of room to maneuver there. So
you gave me a lot of maneuvering room. That's true. I mean, I'm not one of the people who the sort of armchair barroom experts who kind of criticize in hindsight things that were done by governments and by scientists who were, you know, come on, let's face it, they were facing a situation for which there had been no previous parallel. And they didn't know. And they were working hard. Different aspects of the problem were unfolding. The information was changing all the time. And scientists and governments had to keep pace with the changing understanding of what was happening. So it's all very well to say we should have done this, we should have done that, and you know, I'm a great believer that mainly in life, it's cock-ups, not conspiracies. I mean, there's some people who think it's all conspiracies, but I think it's largely cock-ups, and mainly we had a lot of cock-ups during. During right. the evolution of our ideas, both scientific and political, about how to handle that pandemic.
Well, then we can back out of the pandemic conversation, but I think still very much apply your position to the larger questions of life, which is cock-ups, as you put them. What a delightful term, by the way.
British English. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I love it. I mean, just so you know, my wife and I have recently gotten upset. Like in the last year, we've been obsessed with British television shows. So whether it's Poldark or The Crown, I feel like I've been spending as much time in your world as mine. But you know, to some degree, cock-ups or boondoggles or call them even just accidents, they are predetermined by the conditions in which they occur, and that this excessively left-brained or need to control or need to simplistically lock into sound bites and, you know, sort of this polarized way of being and thinking in the world that is, you know, that is the environment in which we find ourselves. It is a great environment in which to make a lot of grand scale catastrophes as a species.
That's a fair point. And nobody's a greater opponent of the black and white way in which all things these days are discussed, particularly on social media, than I am. I mean, I think this is, again, one of the absolutely core errors of our thinking. And again, it's a typical manifestation of the left hemisphere. It literally doesn't understand the complexities, the things that are implicit rather than wholly explicit. It doesn't understand the possibility that two things that look like opposites may coexist, and they may actually give life to one another. And sometimes one has to harmonize two things. It's no good just thinking, well, this is good, and therefore everything else is, you know, its opposite is necessarily bad. Its opposite may have some good, and the thing that you think is so good may have its dark side as well. I mean, this is a major insight of Jung's, but it's also thousands of years old, that things and their opposites coincide. So the idea that we should think in these cut and dried black and white terms is a huge mistake, and it's another left hemisphere typical maneuver. But what I think one could say is that in responding to it, I wouldn't say that in the initial phases, when we really weren't sure what we were facing, and that projected, you know, millions and millions of people were going to be dying of this disease, I think it's hard to criticize any reaction that people had in the face of such an overwhelming and unknown potential threat. But what I think is worrying is the way in which we allowed government to make a huge step forward in intruding in our personal lives. And I'm talking here about all this business of, you know, what we called in Britain, the pingdemic, of people sort of being tracked everywhere in their movements and being alerted to the fact that they might have been in proximity to another person who had COVID. This was a fantasy of the left hemisphere's doing, trying to control, trying to make certain. And in the process, making huge inroads into human dignity, personal privacy, and so on, and subjecting us to a kind of universal surveillance. So on that point, I'm absolutely sure that it reflects what I believe to be the drive of the left hemisphere towards increasing control and power.
Hey there, sorry to interrupt the show, but I just have a quick favor to ask. So we recently broke into the top 100 podcasts in the entrepreneurship category. We've been hovering around 75, and we're really trying to push up into like the top 20 and grow the impact of the show. So if you enjoy what we do here and you're a supporter, the biggest thing you could do to help would be to leave us a positive review. Whatever platform you're listening on, you should be able to leave a quick review. Let the world know what you like about the show. Thank you so much for your time, and let's get back to it.
So the left hemisphere, I suppose one, and again, I'm trying to be sensitive to much of the audience, perhaps, who hasn't read the book. But again, when we say left hemisphere, we're talking the sort of the narrowing of field of focus and vision and even thought and idea. And also, I think the shortening of time horizon, right, where the left brain is really sure. Focused on like getting food now, let's say, because I'm hungry.
Yeah.
To some degree, the bias toward left hemisphere thinking or the dominance of the left brain would theoretically increase the more desperate one's circumstances are. Because there's an urgency to solving whatever it is that has us feeling desperate. And so I'm curious, you mentioned that there's this sort of cycle that civilizations go through where, I guess, in the latter, on the backside of the curve, they become more left brain dominant. You know, I just read Ray Dalio's book, Principles for Dealing with a Changing New World Order, that looks at macroeconomic cycles and makes a very objective and I think non-emotional argument that the Western world, particularly America, is on the backside of our civilizational cycle. Meanwhile, we have China on the ascendancy. Mm. And which, by the way, is a great reflection on long-term thinking, because Chinese structurally and politically, they think in much longer time intervals than we do. But I wonder, do you think that part of this emergence of left brain dominant behavior, and I'm going to use behavior, not just thought, because it's how it gets operationalized that really matters. Do you think that is in some way reflective of us in the Western world having a general sense that we're on the decline and there's a little bit of a desperation kicking in?
It's a good point. Fear intensifies kind of local thinking. It tightens the focus, and which is why when you're under pressure, you're not necessarily or most creative, because it narrows the window of attention, and it literally does this at the level of brain networks, so that the left hemisphere is so structured actually that it has more sort of locally focused areas, whereas the right hemisphere has enormous amounts of interrelationship between all parts of that hemisphere, and it's generally much easier using the right hemisphere to unlock a sort of mental spasm in which one's got focused on one particular thing and can't let go of it. So you're right that when people become fearful, anxious, they don't work intelligently or at their best. However, that's not the same thing as saying that if they're excited and they have a certain sense of adrenaline, you know, then that can motivate to new ideas and is entirely productive. But you're talking about a whole civilization, and I think there are a load of things that cause these cycles. I mean, one is simply that they are very effective at building empires. And, you know, empires, it's hard to say about a country or a civilization, don't seek to broaden and take in and dominate other markets, other worlds, other peoples, because there is this sort of natural expansion. Well, we could do this and we can improve this and we can draw further people and further areas of production under this one same umbrella. This is addictive, of course, because you become richer, you become more powerful. But the trouble is that it also, in the end, is spelling disaster, because it's making you less creative, less imaginative, less satisfied, less perceptive. In the beginning of the book, of The Matter With Things, there's about 400 pages in which I look at the I think over 5,600 pieces of scientific research. I'm aiming there to be pretty comprehensive. I don't think anybody else has looked at these issues of brain hemisphere differences in anything like this degree of depth. And what I'm saying there and showing and demonstrating is that the left hemisphere is not as good as the right hemisphere at attending, perceiving, forming judgments about what's going on, understanding things both emotionally and cognitively and socially. And it's not as creative. It's only good at grabbing. But because some people are addicted to grabbing and getting, you know, oh, I can have that, I can have more of it, they try and build a society that reflects that. So we've all become these people who think that our happiness, our well-being, our mental well-being and our physical well-being can be aided by this kind of mentality. But we know that it can't. You began by talking about even physical well-being as being affected by the way in which we use our minds, and it is. What I've shown in my research, both in the matter with things and in the earlier Master and His Emissary, is that there are three overall things that seem to lead to health. And by health, I mean psychological health, physical health, and spiritual health. And these are belonging to a cohesive society, being close to and involved with the natural world, and having a spiritual life involving spiritual practices. These three things have been shown by a mass of research to make people obviously less vulnerable to psychological distress, more resilient, cognitively more functional, and actually improve their physical health. These things are as valuable as stopping smoking, going to the gym, you know, taking tablets to reduce your blood pressure. The effects are overwhelming, and they're cataloged in those two books.
Can we restate
books.
Them quickly? It was belonging to a cohesive society, having some connection to nature, I believe. And what was the third?
Yes. The third was, having a spiritual element in your life, having spiritual beliefs and spiritual practices involved in your life. I mean, of course, if you do these things only because you think it'll help you be a more effective entrepreneur, then you vitiate the whole point of them because they won't work. They only work when you espouse them because they are in themselves good and true and beautiful. We've lost track of these important values. We have only the value of utility, of pleasure. And we seem to have lost these important values of the beautiful, the good, the true, and the sacred. And it's these things that make a difference. You know, you may say, well, that's all very well, it's a bit airy-fairy, but I just really, I've got this company, I want it to work. But when you're approaching death, what is it you want out of your life? To have been fulfilled as a human being, to have been happy, to have been healthy, to have been imaginatively stimulated, to have helped other people, to have been involved with their lives, to feel belonging in the world, belonging in a society, belonging in nature, or just to have utilized it all, exploited people, exploited resources, as we say, and help leave a trail of destruction behind you. I just like everyone to think about that one.
Well, you know, I'll tell you one of the defining moments of my life, at least intellectually, that has had a massive ripple effect was, and again, I talked about how I have this love of you know, etymology and semantics. I'm sort of a word, I guess, call me a word nerd. But one thing that really shifted me was I happened one day to look up the origin of the word fulfillment. And it comes from an old English word, fulfillon, which has sort of a various connotations, but one of the strongest is that of prophecy. That fulfillon is essentially a manifestation of that which has been prophesied. And that in that sense, you know, to put it bluntly, in order to be fulfilled, we need to do what we were created to do. We need to do what the prophecy foretold, there shall be man and man shall do this. And if man does this, man will be fulfilled, right? And so I think that a lot of what must be happening in society is a diminution or with some people, it seems an outright cessation of the asking of why. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? Why is this what's getting my attention versus something else? But the reality is, why is a very right brain question.
It certainly is. The questions why and how are particularly important to the right hemisphere. How, in the sense of in what way? So I completely agree. I feel that the problem is that, you know, you've started by referring to the idea that people are unhappy, dissatisfied, unfulfilled. Why? Because we haven't the foggiest idea what we're doing here, what a human being is, or what our lives are for. We think of them only as to do with fulfilling certain material needs, amassing a certain amount of stuff, competing with other people. But there's a hell of a lot more to life than that. And in a functioning society, we would begin by bringing our children up in such a way that they understood that there is so much more that they're blinded to by this kind of rhetoric and this way of thinking. So I feel very sorry for people who are stuck in this world. They probably think they're doing incredibly well because they're making a lot of money. But listen, you know, look at the face of Putin, you know? Does he look a happy man? But he has power over the life and death of millions of people, unfortunately. And he also possesses the most expensive lavatory paper dispenser in the world. Now, isn't that going to make you really happy? No, it is not. I mean, the number of people that I've seen who, you know, have everything in inverted commas, but basically have got nothing because they've squandered, they've given away their birthright, they've sold their souls, you know, to use a biblical phrase, they've sold their souls. And there is nothing more valuable you have than your soul. So nurture it, help it to grow.
So what do you say then to the person? Because I think we have to acknowledge, you know, that most people are subject to their environment much more than they're in control of it, no matter how conscientious and proactively we try to live, right? Like we're the worm, right? And so, you know, somebody might say, well, you know, Jeff is financially successful and he doesn't have these, you know, more pedestrian concerns. And Dr. McGilchrist is, has been able to create a life for himself where he has the luxury to sit on the Isle of Skye and walk around and contemplate. And, you know, even coming out of the university system, that's a system that tries to create a, you know, forgive the term, but almost an artificial insularity or bubble around you in which you can do your creative work and not be burdened with the, you know, pedestrian world. But most people don't have either of those going for them, right? And they're, you know, in terms of Maslow's hierarchy, they're much more anchored into the bottom three levels, let's say. And so practically, again, maybe this is my left brain asking on behalf of the left brains of the audience. Practically, how does somebody start to actionalize a shift toward a more cohesive and fulfilling way of being in the world when they're still operating inside of a context that feels most of the time like they're at the red line of need or urgency or just mere survival?
Well, the first thing to say is that we're not as powerless as you projected when you started.
Thank you. I hope everybody heard that.
No, it's true. And we make choices. You say, and I know you're speaking for, as it were, this imagined person who says Dr. McGilchrist has the luxury of living on Skye. There are choices to be made. And, you know, I chose a lot of things that people wouldn't like. It's hard here. It's cold. a lot of the year. It's remote. There aren't all the shops. I can't get takeaway. You know, there are a thousand things that people would think of as part of their daily life that just aren't part of the daily life that you might have if you made a choice about your life. And I actually made a choice to come here because I was desperate for the contact with the beauty and majesty of the natural world. And also I needed to have space and time in order to think. And to do that, I took a 90% pay cut. I mean, when I came to live here, I stopped working as a doctor, and I basically earned next to nothing. I mean, I'm now earning a bit from my books, which is nice. But you also, I mean, the idea of, you know, the ivory tower where you're nurtured and you can be creative. There's some truth in that I was very lucky to have a period when I was given a fellowship, which allowed me to expand my intellectual horizons. But I was creative during a time when I was working flat out. So I was working 120 hours a week, and not just working in some nebulous way. I was working pacing the wards of hospitals, and I was responsible for a neuro high care unit, and I had three small children. So I wasn't in any position of having loads of time and the luxury of contemplation, not a bit. At the end, I was working, when I was writing The Master and His Emissary, I was writing it at night, and I was writing it at the weekends. And I was driven by a demon, basically, to write The Matter with Things. I mean, it brooked no refusals from me. I mean, for the last 3 years before it was published, I didn't take a day off. I just worked all day. So, yeah, what I want to say here is life can take many courses. I chose to become a poor medical student after having been a kind of admired academic. And that wasn't easy, I mean, in terms of money or time. So I don't buy this idea that we can't do things. Okay, I was lucky, and I understand that, you know, not everybody can do the things that I've done. I'm not holding myself up in any way, but I'm only mentioning this in order to suggest that it is a fantasy to suppose that the people who are creative have easy lives. They don't. They make choices. They make the choices that allow them to be the person they want to be. And we can all do that. And it may involve starting again. You know, at the age of 28, having got one of the most prestigious, I have to say this, awards in the academic world, in the entire academic world, I went back to being a student, you know, like an 18-year-old student at high school learning chemistry and things and having no income. I mean, you have to make choices. In the end, of course, I got where I wanted to be. I became a doctor, and, you know, but life has its ups and downs. It has its frantically busy times. I mean, there was 6-9 years of my life when my brain was put through a blender, it felt like, you know, because at home there were children everywhere. In the hospital, there were the demands of patients, there were night, you know, I used to start work on a Friday morning at 7 o'clock, and I wouldn't finish until Monday night at 7 o'clock. And during that time, I got an occasional hour of sleep when I could lie down. And it's it wasn't a piece of cake. That's all I'm really saying is, I think this is very important for people to hear, because I'm not saying, oh, how wonderful and all the rest. I'm really just saying, don't buy this story that you haven't got any free will. You have. You're not a machine. You're not predestined. This is the way in which we now think, oh, we're all just cogs in a machine, but we are not. So push out. Go for what you want, but don't expect it to be easy. Recognize you will have to be poor, you will have to work hard, and you may win the prizes. That's the way life works. Sorry.
No, I'm so grateful that I asked that question, and I appreciate you sharing some of your personal backstory. You know, I have a theory that you know, I suppose like all scientific theories, it's always open to question. But I also think that, like, let's say the theory, it, like for me, it's about as true as the theory of gravity. Like I say theory in the sense that like, I've yet to be challenged, let's say, that worrying about other people's opinions and the weight which we give other people's opinions is the greatest ball and chain that most people drag around. It is the greatest constriction of human potential. And in even my show and my book, my work, it's, you know, this concept of unlocking your potential. I mean, you boil the water out of the pan, there's a few little crumbs in there. And one of them is, thou shalt give no F what other people think. And so my point is, you said you went through a period where you made choices that other people would not have made. And I don't know what that time of your life was like, but there may well have been people who doubted you or questioned you or even made you feel self-conscious about what you were doing. I know that I'm going through, you know, and I feel like I'm always going through some degree of I am bedded down in the long game of a choice that I have made that other people don't understand. And if I let them into my proximity, if I let them into my, you know, foveal circle, they will tell me all about how much they don't agree with what I've chosen. And so I've decided that pretty much one of the keys to success is to do a vast amount of saying no to things and people. And that, but we've kind of lost that ability because it's a chicken and egg thing. We're in a world where we care so much what people think badly of us when we say no to caring what they think, and we don't, and then we can't, and then we die with regret.
There's a huge amount in that. I absolutely would second your view that caring too much about what other people think is a huge mistake. What I want to get away from, though, and because I was also going to say, is taking other people's advice is sometimes also a big mistake. But I want to get away, what I want to distance myself from at the same time is saying that we shouldn't care about other people and their views. We should just be independent enough to go, that's fine, they think that, but I think I'm going to do this. So it's good to listen, it's good to understand, it's good to respect others, but then you make your own decisions. And I've done that a lot in my life, and you're absolutely right. A lot of people said, that's a very bold move. And that has been the story of my life, people saying that. I've never regretted any of the decisions I've made. Well, hardly any, let's put it that way. But I mean, on the whole, I've also discovered that in life, going to the experts is not necessarily the best way to understand something. Of course, you'd be an idiot to suppose that you can dispense with other people's knowledge about something. Listen to what they have to say. But if you can see a very good reason why that might not be the full story, then don't feel bad about rejecting it. The number of times where I have gone to an expert, and in the end, I've had to say to the expert, but what if we did this? And they would go, yeah, okay, that's a good idea. And I was thinking, yeah, I'm paying you, a couple of hundred pounds an hour for coming up with the ideas. But really, in the end, I've often taken my own advice, and I've been lucky, I guess, because on the whole, it's worked. It has its hairy side, but it also has its life enhancing side.
Well, and
so there we are.
Yeah, but but what contrasted with what? This is what I ask people. I challenge people on is, yes, there is risk. Yes, there is uncertainty. Yes, there is possible disaster, but contrasted with what? With the futility, the emptiness of a mechanized reactive existence that you talk about certainty. A lot of people, we can sort of empirically assess their lives, and you say, you want certainty? I will give you a certainty of regret based on the number of times that you resist your own impulses to make a different choice because you know something's amiss. You're creating certainty. It's just the opposite of the certainty that you want.
That's really what I've been saying, is that if we choose to aim for certainty, we will produce only one certainty, which is mediocrity, failure, boredom, and in fact, a non-life. I mean, I think a lot of people are choosing not to live before they die. Come on, we've got to live. And life is a risky business, guys. This is okay. I mean,
so I feel like for the second time in my life, I just heard somebody from Scotland proclaim, "Every man dies, but not every man truly lives." That was William Wallace in Braveheart. but it's true.
Right.
It's okay. True.
Oh, it is true.
Thank you. I've overkept your committed stay, and I'm so grateful. I got a little carried away because, as I said earlier, I've been so excited to have this conversation. And I think we've ended on a really, really nice exclamation point, which is, again, in view of the audience and a lot of entrepreneurial stirrings within the audience, I can never tell you what the outcome is going to look like. I can never tell you what the future holds. I can only promise you that the journey will be worth it, but the journey requires letting go of the false need for certainty of outcome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's it.
That's it.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening. Especially if you like or share or leave a review, thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.